Up next, an interview with retired astronaut Robert Hoot Gibson.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with retired astronaut Robert Hoot Gibson. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. Hoot Gibson was an astronaut at NASA and flew 5 space shuttle missions. He commanded 4 of them. He also docked with the Mir space station. He now shares his experiences with us. We're speaking with Hoot Gibson, retired NASA astronaut. Captain, does this conversation find you in good health?
Oh, golly, yes. Yes. Yeah, doing fine. I guess I'm getting old at this point, but I'm still exercising regularly. And I'm in good health, and I hope you are too.
I am. How did you get your nickname, and how did you become an astronaut?
Well, the nickname, I had kind of had it occasionally, you know, once in a while in high school, in college, occasionally somebody would call me Hoot. And, of course, that comes from the old cowboy movie star who was Hoot Gibson. Started out in silent movies, and then he was one of the few cowboy stars that made the transition into talking movies. And so it's kind of a semi-automatic nickname. So the funny story I tell is when I joined my fighter squadron aboard the Coral Sea, flying F-4 Phantoms, the ops officer, when I first got there, you know, I was a nugget. I was a new pilot, just out of pilot training, just out of qualification in the F-4 Phantom. In the what the Navy calls the RAG squadron, the Readiness Air Group, and I show up in the Tonkin Gulf to replace a crew that had been sort of shot down, and the ops officer asked me, he said, "Well, kid, have you got a nickname?" "Well, my real name's Robert," so I said, "Oh, yes, sir, it's Bob." And he said, "No, come on, I need a real nickname." And I said, "Well, occasionally in the past, I've been called Hoot." Bang. That was it. From that moment on, I was no longer Robert. I was no longer Bob. I was Hoot. So Hoot went on my airplane, on the canopy rail. It said, "Lieutenant J.G. Hoot Gibson." Hoot went on my name tag. Hoot went on my squadron coffee cup. And from that point on, I was Hoot.
So it stuck.
It stuck. Yes, it stuck.
You were flying as a JG?
Yes. I flew 1972. I flew a bunch of combat missions as a 25-year-old.
Wow.
And so that was, you know, the old baptism of fire.
Sure.
And so I had been a Navy fighter pilot, and all my life, Rich, I had wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer and a test pilot because he was my inspiration. And so I was focused on getting to do those two things. And by golly, it worked out. I did graduate in aeronautical engineering and went right in the Navy and got to fly jet fighters and then got to go to test pilot school. And you asked, you know, how I got to be an astronaut. Well, it had not been in my sights when I was young, because I was an airplane person. Things I flew had wings on them. The Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo capsules didn't have any wings, so I wasn't interested in doing that. And partly because I didn't realize how much actual flying they did, that they actually had to do, manual control with the spacecraft and all. Mm-hmm. But I remember I was flying, I was in the Navy's first F-14 Tomcat squadron in about 1974, and I remember looking through an aviation magazine, and I turned the page, and here's an artist concept of a space shuttle flying a reentry to glide back down and land. And I saw that, and I said, oh, man, I have got to get me one of those. From that moment on, I was determined that I wanted to get to fly space shuttles. And so it wasn't a real big change of direction. I knew I wanted to go to test pilot school, and I knew if I wanted to be a pilot astronaut, I'd have to be a graduate of test pilot school. So that was where I started focusing on, I really want to do this. And talk about lucky, I got selected on my first try in 1978. And then spent 18 years with NASA.
Was that the class with John McBride?
Yes, it was. Yeah, you must have spoken to him. Now, he's a character, isn't he?
Yeah. I've interviewed him twice. I actually had him over to the house, interviewed him over a beer.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, John's he's quite the character. Kind of quiet, mild-mannered, but he knows his stuff.
He's kind of quiet and mild-mannered, but once you get him talking...
I couldn't stop him. I couldn't stop him.
Yeah, you're going to hear it all is what I was going to add, so yeah.
Okay, we're talking about the same guy. And
yes,
one of the questions I had about for him... Because I remember, who was it? Joe Kerwin mentioned during the NBC broadcast of the first shuttle landing, he said that John McBride would be mortified if he missed the rendezvous with the shuttle when he was flying the T-38.
Oh, golly, wouldn't we all? Well, I was in his position for STS-2.
Oh, really?
The very next mission.
I was there for that landing.
Oh, okay.
I was actually at Edwards for that landing. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I was Chase One, and, you know, it was a point of honor as to, okay, how high do you intercept them? And, of course, we were hoping to be on Columbia's wing by 30,000 feet. And we were holding at 35,000 feet because we had picked a spot that we knew Columbia had to go pass through. And we picked a point where it was slow enough that we could stay with it in the chase planes. And so we'd hold at 35,000 feet. That gave us a little bit of maneuvering space. And we wanted to be aboard by 30,000 feet and in close formation. And then, of course, we'd chase them all the rest of the way down and call off touchdown height and airspeeds and things like that.
And you had to fly dirty, right?
Yes. In order to get the drag, you're right, we had to have the gear down. So we had a special modification to the T-38s. We had F5 gear doors on them because we could drop the gear doors at 280 knots instead of the standard 240 knots. So that helped us. And we had enlarged speed brakes, 50% bigger than the normal T-38 speed brakes. And the other thing we could do was put down 40% flaps, 40% of full travel. And that let us go to at least 300 knots indicated airspeed, 300 knots with the flaps down. If you started to go faster than that, then you had to raise the flaps. All the way up. But yes, we had to be real dirty to have as much drag as a space shuttle.
Wow. Yeah, because there's a whole different aerodynamic concern between those two aircraft. You know.
Oh, golly, yes.
And the one's not an aircraft, the one is a flying rock, you know?
Yeah, or a brick. Yeah.
Dropping rock, yeah.
Yes.
No, that's really cool information because that's just... You know, for our audience, what happens is the first few shuttle flights, they would send up chase aircraft, which were training aircraft, T-38s, to rendezvous with the shuttle to provide video coverage and guidance and information and safety, different things early on in the program because it was still in the testing phase, to get up there and rendezvous with a vehicle that just came back from orbit going, what was it, 25 Mach?
Yes, Mach 25 is the initial speed when we hit the top of the atmosphere in the space shuttle. And an interesting, golly, an interesting data point here, Rich, is that we would have mission control give us a mark at Mach 9 when the space shuttle had slowed all the way down to Mach 9. Okay, I'm being facetious. Mach 9 isn't very slow, but no. it had slowed all the way down from Mach 25 to Mach 9. And so what you would hear in those early flights is you'd hear mission control come up and say, Chase, stand by for a mark at Mach 9. Mach 9.
I remember
because
that.
Because that was 9 minutes prior to intercept. So basically the shuttle is slowing down one Mach number per minute from that point. And so they'd give us that mark, and then that would help us look at our timing, because we'd be in basically a holding pattern at the entry point, and you'd adjust the length of the legs that you flew in the holding pattern so that you could be right at the intercept point on time.
And if I remember right, the first flight, there were two Capcoms on entry, Joe Allen and Rick Hawk. And one of them was calling off that Mach that you're talking about, the mark point.
Yeah, I know the two of them were there. I wasn't really aware of which one made that particular call.
Yeah, they were alternating. Joe Allen was doing the comm with the spacecraft as far as casual conversation, but I think Rick was doing those specifics, if I remember right. I could be wrong.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true, because that call for us in the chase plans wouldn't have gone over the S-band system. It would have been the ultra-high frequency radio, the UHF radio.
Oh, okay. So it wouldn't have been air-to-ground. It would have been UHF.
That's true. We couldn't pick up air-to-ground. But the shuttle, for re-entry, we would enable the UHF transmission and receiving on board the shuttle, so that when Joe Engel, in the case of STS-2, which was my mission to be Chase 1, when he would key his mic to talk on the air to ground, we could hear him on the UHF once he got within close enough range.
So it got repeated over so you could hear it?
Yes, it would go out simultaneously over the S-band and also over the UHF radio.
Well, this is information for me because I thought jet aircraft used VHF.
Well, in the T-38s, we had both. Now, most of your military aircraft are using UHF only, the ultra-high frequency. And in the NASA T-38s, because we flew into so many civilian airfields, we had VHF as well. So we could use both of them.
Okay. Well, I'm stretching this out quite a way here.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're having fun.
Your first flight was, we're speaking with retired astronaut Hoot Gibson. Your first flight was on in 1984, February. I was in the Air Force basic training at the time, so I couldn't watch it. Bruce McCandless flew a manned maneuvering unit, basically a jet backpack with no tether. What were the backup procedures in case his equipment failed and you had to rescue him?
That's a good question. We had developed a set of procedures that was titled EVA Crew Member Rescue, EVA being extravehicular activity or spacewalk. So we had a set of procedures, and what we had to do for the actual spacewalk was we would have the orbiter configured over to the very small thruster rockets, what we call the vernier thrusters. And those vernier thrusters had just 25 pounds of thrust, and those were plenty enough to manage attitude control. In other words, which way we were pointing in the space shuttle. But when it was time to translate, to move the shuttle in orbit, we'd have to use the big thrusters. So what we had to do for EVA crew member rescue was go through a set of procedures to enable the big thrusters, the primary thrusters that had 900 pounds of thrust, and we had to enable them in a safe mode so that we wouldn't fire any of the up-firing thrusters, because that's the direction our crew members would be. Now, we didn't need to use it for the crew member rescue, because everything worked just fine on the rocket pack that both Bruce McCandless and Bob Stewart flew, and they flew out 330 feet away from Challenger, and then back to Challenger, of course. But we did get to exercise that procedure, because one of those boys, when they were out in the cargo bay, they kicked loose a foot platform.
Oh, no.
And the foot platform floated up out of the cargo bay and was floating away from Challenger. And Vance Brand was the mission commander. And Vance said, heck, I'm going to go get it. Let's get on the procedure. So we told Bruce and Bob, neither one of them was out flying the rocket pack at that point. We told them, hey, get in the cargo bay and hang on. We're going to go rescue that foot platform. So we went through the procedures, brought up the big thrusters, maneuvered Challenger over there, and flew it right into the cargo bay where Bruce McCandless could just reach up and grab it. So we actually did get to exercise the EVA crew member rescue procedure.
I've attended 7 landings at Edwards in California. You had the challenge of landing at night. The only lighting that I know of on the runway was from the sides, those Xeon lamps. How hard was that to pull off?
That was a challenging landing, Rich, but, you know, not nearly as challenging as a night carrier landing.
Oh, I'll bet.
It was a whole lot bigger target than an aircraft carrier, and we didn't have the aircraft carriers lit up like the xenon lights light up that runway.
So, right.
But the situation for me was, this was my first time as mission commander, and so this was my first opportunity to make the landing of the shuttle, and we were supposed to land at Florida right at daybreak. And for 3 days in a row, the weather was socked in down at the Cape.
Oh, man.
And so we tried for 3 days, and finally, on the third day...
they got to call it. It's just like you're coming down somewhere.
Oh, golly, yeah. Yeah. So we have built in a good 2 days of extension, you know, on the electrical power and everything else on the orbiter, so we can extend that long, because obviously we did. And so we landed, tomorrow, 37 years ago, at Edwards, and we waved off from the Cape for the third time, and Mission Control said, guys, the weather is still no-go at the Cape, so take it one more orbit, and you're going to land it at Edwards on runway 22 at Edwards.
That was my next question, 23 or 22? So
yeah, two,
that's
two.
You didn't take the big runway at a night landing?
We couldn't use the lake bed at night because you stir up so much dust that it's going to block the light from the xenon lights.
Oh.
And in addition, none of those lake bed runways out there, runway 23, of course, being a lake bed runway, none of those had runway edge lights or anything on them.
Well, 22 is a whole lot smaller. I mean, that's a smaller target to put your second wire on.
Well, it's still, let's see, I'm trying to remember. I think it's 15,000 feet long. It's not quite as wide as the shuttle runway down at the Cape. I want to say it's like 250 feet wide, where the shuttle runway at Cape Canaveral is 300 feet wide. But even so, it's a plenty big enough target. And so none of the night landings could ever be done to the lake bed. They all had to be to a hard surface runway.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired astronaut Hoot Gibson. On STS-71, you docked with the Russian space station Mir. Were there any procedures required to equalize the atmospheric content, like nitrogen, oxygen, when you opened the hatches, because they might not have been compatible like back in the Apollo-Soyuz mission?
Oh, golly, yes. They actually were not compatible because now we knew ahead of time before we launched that the mirror was down to about 12 pounds per square inch, 12 PSI. And aboard the space shuttle, we always stayed at standard sea level pressure, which is 14.7 pounds per square inch. We always stayed right at that pressure unless we were going to be doing spacewalks. So when I docked with Mir, and this was, by the way, the very first docking ever done by a space shuttle. So I had the thrill and the privilege of getting to make the very first docking by a shuttle. And once we got there, we knew they were at 12 PSI. We were at 14.7 PSI. We cannot try to open the hatch between the two vehicles with that kind of a pressure differential. So what we had to do was, once we got firmly attached and firmly docked with them, was we have equalization valves in the hatch itself. We opened both equalization valves and we pumped a ton of air into the Mir space station. We repressurized their entire station for them. So it took, I'm trying to remember, it was probably 15 or 20 minutes of pumping air into the Russian Mir space station. And their volume, their total volume, I think was greater than ours on the shuttle. And what the shuttle does, though, is we were making up our atmosphere as we were losing it into the Mir space station. And we have an automatic system that flows either nitrogen or oxygen, or I guess possibly both, if the automatic system sees that we need both, to keep us at 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, just like sea level, just like we all are here at sea level. And so while we're giving them all this air, we're making it up on board the shuttle as well.
So you knew all this in advance, and there was no danger of somebody getting the bends or anything like that?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. So we knew we were going to have to repressurize them. Golly, we should have charged them for it, you know, because carrying all that air up to 211 nautical miles, let's see, about 240 miles up, carrying all that air is, you know, that's worth a lot. So we helped them a lot. We also gave them about 1,100 pounds of water over the time we were docked with them.
Well, you should charge them for that.
Should have charged for that, too, yeah.
the air that you speak of, was that in auxiliary tanks, or it just got made up by your system on the shuttle?
It's made up by the system, Rich, and what we have is we have liquid oxygen. They're referred to as Dewars, D-E-W-A-R-S, Dewars, liquid oxygen tanks. They're great big 4-foot diameter tanks full of liquid oxygen, and then we had tanks full of liquid nitrogen as well. And so when we would need to add either one of those elements to the cabin, the automatic system would say, okay, we're just a little bit low on pressure. I need to flow something. And we're a little bit low on nitrogen, so I'm going to flow nitrogen. So it would do that. And so it kept us right at 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen automatically.
Yeah, and that's something most people don't know. We don't breathe 100% oxygen on Earth. It's mostly nitrogen. And in fact, that was the undoing of Apollo 1 when they had the fire, because it was 100% oxygen. And I mean, that fire went fast.
Oh, it certainly was. And you're so right. And you know, the big question you say to yourself is, okay, what will burn in that kind of an environment? They were also 2 PSI, 2 pounds per square inch higher pressure than normal sea level pressure. And so high pressure, 100% oxygen, what will burn in that environment? The answer is everything.
Anything. Yeah, I had a conversation with Roy Neal. He was a NBC news reporter back in the day. He specialized in the space program, and he had books and books about this stuff and just, you know, terrible stories about what went wrong and how could it happen, and And it was basically begging for trouble. And at the time, and I didn't know why the Soviet Union would use a whole bunch of nitrogen in their Soyuz spacecraft. Well, now I know why.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, in hindsight, I'm sure NASA looked at it. Of course, this was 1967, way before I ever joined NASA. But I'm sure in hindsight, NASA looked at that and said, how could we have failed to see this?
Well, they were looking at the basic needs of the human body. You have to have oxygen. So they didn't, you know, plus carrying a nitrogen tank, well, you're adding weight. And the engineers probably thought, no, you know, this isn't worth the weight.
Well, and the other side to that equation, too, is, and you referred to it, the bends. They wanted to eliminate nitrogen out of the astronauts' blood. And all of our lunar missions, of course, they were going to be doing spacewalks. They were going to be going outside in a suit at reduced pressure. And when you go from a high pressure to a low pressure, then the nitrogen in your blood wants to bubble up and give you the bends. And so part of the story was, okay, we're gonna get rid of all the nitrogen. And that's going to help us later on when it's time to go outside on a spacewalk.
Oh, I do have to ask this. On that mission to the Russian space station, Mir, were there any language barriers? Did you all have any problems communicating with each other?
Да, конечно. Мы говорим, мы нужно говорим по-русски. We had to study Russian. Now, prior to my getting assigned to the Mir docking mission, I was the chief astronaut, so I was the head of the astronaut corps. And to show some leadership, I signed up to take Russian language lessons along with my guys and gals that were going to be doing the Russian missions and spending time in Russia. So I had a couple years of Russian language instruction, not embedded in it, maybe 2 hours a week, that sort of thing. And then when I got assigned to command the Mir docking mission, my whole crew, initially, we would do about 3 hours a week of Russian language training, because the Russians, at the time, they were financially challenged and weren't able to hire English teachers or buy English textbooks, and they couldn't speak English, so we had to make the effort to learn to speak Russian.
Well, not only that, you had to read Russian, which isn't Cyrillic.
Yes. Well, you know what? The beauty of the Russian language is words are pronounced precisely the way they're spelled.
Just like German, yeah.
Yeah, so once you have figured out that awkward Russian alphabet, which has 33 characters as compared to our 26 characters, and their characters are Greek, Arabic, and Cyrillic, where ours are all Arabic. So once you got used to that, you could read Russian very, you know, very well. And I'm not fluent in Russian. In fact, anytime I'm going to have to speak Russian to somebody, Rich, I will start off by telling them, Я говорю по-русски очень плохо и понимаю ничего.
Нет.
Which is, I speak Russian very badly and understand nothing. But I don't want them to get their expectations up too high. But then the joke I tell when I speak out in public, after I tell them that's what I know to say best in Russian, I mention that when I launched aboard Atlantis to go to the Russian space station, I had two cosmonauts with me, Anatoly Soloviev and Nikolai Budarin, who are going to take over the Mir space station. And I'm going to pick up the three who have been there for 4 months. This is the only time ever that there was a Russian crew changeout performed by an American spacecraft. But the joke I tell is that, okay, what happens if during launch I need to tell Anatoly and Nikolai, Извините, пожалуйста, у нас есть маленький пожар на борту прямо сейчас. Which is, excuse me, please, we have a small fire on board right now.
Oh, geez.
So we needed to be at least conversant in Russian. And like I say, I am not fluent. I am so very far from fluent, it's amazing. But I can carry on a very poor conversation in Russian, even to this day.
were you, was that the 7 up, 8 down mission?
Yes, sir. Yes, it was.
Where did they put the extra seat? Was that on the mid-deck?
The three cosmonauts who had been up there for 4 months, we put them essentially on the floor. We had set up some recumbent seats down on the floor of the mid-deck. So we had four astronauts upstairs, and then we had four people downstairs as well. So they were all in a position with their backs down against the floor of the orbiter, because we don't pull that many G's, but 2 G's after you've been up there for 4 months is going to feel kind of heavy. So they were in what we refer to as recumbent seats on the mid-deck.
Well, that being said, let me ask you this, and I'm pulling this out of thin air, if you will. Were there any redundancies for, okay, we got to get the whole crew off the station and the shuttle happens to be up here? Was there any provisions for that?
No, and I guess I'll say the reason that we didn't plan to do that is that they always have their Soyuz capsule.
Right.
So leaving them behind, we really aren't marooning them. They would prefer to come down in their Soyuz capsule anyway. So Anatoly and Nikolai spent 5 months up there after we dropped them off. And they would have come back in the Soyuz capsule at that point.
What was the crew complement on the Mir?
Two or three cosmonauts. And part of it was being able to support them with water and consumables, the oxygen and nitrogen on board the Mir space station. So, although I guess we built up, let's see, I'm not sure. No, I'm thinking of the International Space Station. We've done 6-member crews on the ISS because it has a whole lot more capability. Whereas on Mir, they would only have more than 3 people for very short periods of time when they're doing a crew exchange or a crew changeout.
How long did it take you to, from launch to rendezvous? Because I'm still confused to this day why it takes 2 days for a shuttle, even though they don't fly anymore, for a shuttle to rendezvous with the ISS. How long did it take you, and why does it take so long? Because back in the Gemini days, they could rendezvous with a target vehicle in one orbit.
Sure. Well, the speed at which you can perform a rendezvous and a docking depends on how much fuel you're willing to hose out the thrusters. And
okay.
So what we were doing is we're doing a very efficient method of rendezvousing with the Russian space station Mir. So initially, when you launch, we would launch about 2,000 miles behind the target. So in other words, in my case, the Mir space station had just passed right over Cape Canaveral, and we let them get to where they're 2,000 miles out in front of us, and then we launch. And what we did was they were up at 211 nautical miles, and a nautical mile is about 115% of a normal mile. So they're about, 2,300 miles out in front of us. And I launched into the lowest orbit that a shuttle had ever flown. We had a high point of 160 nautical miles up and a low point of 85 nautical miles. So we were really low, and we can only stay in an orbit like that for a limited amount of time. But the reason for that low orbit is that we're flying a shorter distance around the Earth than the Mir space station is, up at 211 miles.
So you could catch up.
So we're catching up. So every time we go around the Earth, we're closer to them. And then at some point, I don't remember exactly how long it was, we circularized at 160 miles, and we're still in a significantly lower orbit than they are, so we're closing on them the entire way. And then we will do a burn to raise part of our orbit, And so anyway, the long-winded explanation is that it's more efficient and we burn less fuel by doing it very slowly and over the space of, in our case, it was a day and a half.
And that was an Ohm's burn?
Those are primarily all Ohm's burns. The big burns are certainly all Ohm's burns, either one Ohm's engine or two Ohm's engines. And the Ohm's is the orbital maneuvering system, which is a 6,000-pound thruster. So if it's a big burn, we'll use both of them. That gives us 12,000 pounds of thrust. And if it's a medium-sized burn, we can just use one Ohm's engine.
I didn't know you could just burn one.
Yes, and we would do that frequently. We frequently do a burn that just involved using one engine.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. That's why I'm talking to you.
Sure, yes. Now in the final rendezvous, in what we called the terminal intercept phase, we did a burn that was called TI, terminal intercept. And that's the one that's going to put us on a collision course with the Mir space station. There were a number of mid-course corrections after we did, and again, that burn was called TI, terminal intercept. Once we do TI, there were four mid-course corrections that we would do based on our radar tracking and how are we doing at flying the exact profile that we want to fly. Those burns would not be Ohm's burns. Those would be burns using the big thrusters.
What was the acronym for those thrusters?
RCS.
Darn it, it was on the top of my head.
Oh, sure, yeah, Reaction Control System, yeah,
right.
RCS.
Yeah, RCS so
those,
jets.
Those four mid-course corrections, MC1 through MC4, were RCS burns.
And those are conventional rockets as opposed to, like, APUs that use hydrazine?
Well, they used hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide.
Okay, wow.
Yes, so the thrusters, well, and the Ohm's engines as well, and the thrusters used monomethylhydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide. And those two fuels are, I know you know this expression, those are hypergolic.
Yes.
Which means they can't stand each other. And when you mix them together, they explode.
They got to go somewhere.
You don't need an igniter.
Right.
Like those. You spray those two together and you have an explosion. Well, and that explosion is thrust.
Directed thrust.
Directed thrust, yes.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired astronaut Hoot Gibson. After interviewing so many astronauts, I have totally failed in asking one question. What is an RTLS? Why, when, and how would you perform it?
RTLS was an abort, which means we're not going to make it to space. We're not going to make it very far, in fact. And RTLS stood for Return to Launch Site. Now, that would be a very serious problem that has come up with the space shuttle, to where we've got to cancel the whole mission. We can't even afford to go around the Earth one time. We can't do an abort to orbit, which would be a low orbit. And, for example, if we had a main engine failure, and the main engines are the three engines on the back of the space shuttle, say right at liftoff, one of those engines were to fail. We have just lifted off. 10 seconds after liftoff, one of those engines shuts down. There's no place we can go but back to the launch site. And so what we have got to do is we would declare an RTLS at 2 minutes and 30 seconds. So after 2 minutes and 30 seconds of flight, we would tell the computers, okay, we need to go back and land at the launch site. Now, what we had to do was we had to fly downrange. We had to fly outbound for a particular period of time. And what we've got to do is we have to burn off fuel in the external tank, because we have got to get the external tank down to 2% remaining when we separate from it. Otherwise, the dynamics of fuel sloshing around in that fuel tank could result in a collision when we separate from the tank. So we had to fly outbound, And when I say outbound, I mean away from Cape Canaveral. So let's say we had lost an engine at 1 minute after liftoff. The only place we can go is back to the launch site. So what we're going to do is we're going to fly outbound at a high pitch angle. We're going to pitch up because we don't want to be going down. We want to stay up as high as we can. So we're going to fly a very high pitch angle, and we're going to fly outbound until we get down to, and this is the actual number, 44% fuel remaining in the big orange tank. And then we're going to pitch around to slow down our outbound speed and start flying back towards the Cape. But we have got to dump the tank out in the ocean. So we're going to get to where we're down to about 2% remaining, and we're going to pitch over to a nose low angle and separate from the tank and get rid of the tank and pitch up and do a gliding reentry the rest of the way back to the Cape. So for a portion of time there, we'd be flying backwards. When we do the first pitch around, we're still going outbound at about Mach 8, and we have to pitch around and slow down that outward velocity that we're traveling and start heading back towards the Cape. So we never, fortunately, we never had to do one of those, but it was a kind of a hairy maneuver to be performing. But again, Rockwell had thoroughly analyzed it, and the conclusion was that yes, we'd be able to do it. All the margins of the vehicle would allow us to do it.
What was the end of the window for an RTLS?
The last RTLS would be about 4 minutes. On my first mission, which is the cue card that I'm actually looking at as we're talking here, 4 minutes and 3 seconds was our last RTLS opportunity, because after that point, prior to that, obviously everything has been working fine, or you would have declared an RTLS already. But you're going downrange so fast that you've just barely got enough fuel remaining to be able to do the pitch around and fly back to the Cape. So 4 minutes and 3 seconds after liftoff is the last opportunity.
And after that, it's a TAL? I'm sorry, transatlantic abort?
Yes, although we would prefer a TAL over an RTLS any day. And so if we had reached a point at which we could do a TAL, we would do that instead of an RTLS.
Now, there was one mission that had, as far as I know, only one that had an abort to orbit, an ATO.
Yes, you're so right. And it was July of 1985, and it was mission 51F was the designation of it. And Gordon Fullerton was the commander, and Roy Bridges was the pilot. And they had an engine shut down due to a malfunctioning sensor at about something like 5 minutes into the flight.
It was the center engine.
Was it the center one?
Yeah, okay, I didn't center engine fail. Abort ATO.
And so, yes, they did an ATO, abort to orbit, ATO. And what we would do is, instead of going for a 160 nautical mile high orbit, we would set our sights lower. We would go into a 105 mile high orbit, because that took less energy and less fuel, and of course we're hurting for performance once we lose one of the engines. So they launched into a 105 mile high orbit, and then over the next couple of hours, mission control sharpened their pencils, calculated how much ohms fuel they had, and calculated, okay, how high an orbit can we go into and still have enough margin for deorbit burn, reentry, and landing. And so they wound up going to I don't remember how high they went, but they went higher than that 105 nautical miles. And therefore, they had a completely successful mission. So we were fortunate that sensor failed at a high enough velocity for them to make it into an ATO.
Well, I'll ask you this. I don't know if this was during or after your career. At one point, they were firing Ohm's engines during the main engine firing.
Yes, and that never happened. That never happened on any of the flights that I was doing. Although I'm trying to think, if we did a TEL, I think if we did a TEL, they would light the Ohm's engines, if for nothing else, just to get rid of the fuel so that we'd be at a lighter weight for landing. So I think if we had a TEL that we had to do, then the Ohm's engines would fire and we would do an RCS dump as well, get rid of RCS fuel. But I never did any of those. So yeah, you're right. I think later on they started using the Ohm's during ascent somewhat routinely.
And the only two abort sites I could think of across the Atlantic were Dakar, Senegal, and Rota, Spain.
Well, we actually had quite a few more than that. Let's see, we were using Dakar, of course, and let's see, where else down there? Banjul, Gambia was another abort site that we had. And we also had, now those were if you launched on a 28.5 degree orbit. Okay, what in the world does that mean? That meant that we were only flying above the Earth from 28.5 degrees north to 28.5 degrees south. So we would launch and head due east out of Cape Canaveral. Some of the higher inclination missions where I had two missions that went to 57 degrees north and south, were heading northeast out of Cape Canaveral, and those used, let's see, Rota, Spain was one of them. What were some of the other ones? Oh, golly, we had other abort sites that we used in Spain. And let's see, on the equatorial launches, the 28.5 degree launches, we also had used Morocco as an abort site as well on some of those missions.
You're listening to The Space Program.
Well, I've got two more questions for you. You advanced into the astronaut office. What were your duties there?
Initially, when we first came aboard, we were astronaut candidates. And the plan was we were going to be astronaut candidates for 2 years. And then if we worked out successfully, then we would get promoted to astronaut. And in our case, actually, we went a year and everyone had done just a shining job. And so the management said, you know what, we don't need to be astronaut candidates for 2 years. We can shut this down and give you your silver astronaut pin. So you got a pin that was basically a shooting star, a silver pin, when it was determined that, okay, from this point on, you're an astronaut. You're not an astronaut candidate anymore. So, and then once you flew, you got a gold astronaut pin, a gold shooting star, a very highly coveted pin, I might add. But to answer your question, we were training for our first 6 months, and then after 6 months, we were given a collateral job in addition. So we're still training. We're still doing what I guess I'll refer to as basic training. But you also had a job where you were supporting some of the upcoming missions. So you had a collateral job to do in the astronaut office as well, in addition to all the training.
Now, you became the head of the astronaut office at one point, didn't you?
Yes, after my fourth mission, at that point, I was the most experienced pilot astronaut in the Corps, and so I was promoted to the position of chief astronaut.
Was that before or after John Young?
It was actually after Dan Brandenstein, who was after John Young. So Dan Brandenstein took over as chief astronaut, and he was one of the astronauts in my class of 78 along with John McBride. Dan Brandenstein became chief astronaut, I want to say it was 86 or 87, I want to say 1986. or 87 is where he took over as chief astronaut, and then he was in that job till 1992, which was when he left NASA. And so I picked up that title and that job towards the end, oh, I guess in about October of 1992.
Yeah, he was the CAPCOM on STS-1, on
yes,
the ascent.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes, he was.
Very distinguished or distinguishable accent that he had. You could tell it was him talking.
Oh, golly, yes. Let's see. He was from Wisconsin. And in fact, that's how he'd pronounce it, Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
You know, I think most of us would say Wisconsin, but it was Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So that's where he was from. That's a very distinct accent, you're right.
And the other guy that had a very distinct speech was Bruce McCandless. He was the CAPCOM on Apollo 11's first EVA, first moonwalk.
Oh, golly, yes. Yeah. Bruce had quite a history with NASA. Well, he waited a long time for his first.
I was just going to say it took him forever to get up. I mean, that was 69, and he didn't go into orbit until he flew with you. I mean, that was quite some time.
Oh, golly, yes. Yeah. Sometimes that space business took a lot of patience.
Yeah, and Joe Engel, well, he could have walked on the moon, but they replaced him on Apollo 17 because they canceled 18, 19, and 20.
Yes.
So they put Harrison Schmitt up there to be a geologist. But Joe got up there. He got up on Enterprise on the drop tests, and then he flew on the shuttle a few times on orbit. Good for him.
He had a distinguished career there as well.
Last important question of all, speaking with retired astronaut Hoot Gibson. Now, I ask this of everybody that I interview, and it always takes them off balance. You know, how do you go to the bathroom and say, no, I'm not going to ask that stupid stuff. It's not going to happen with me. What's your favorite food, and what do you want for Christmas?
Oh, golly, my favorite food in space or down here on the Earth?
On Earth.
Oh, on Earth. My favorite food. Oh, golly, I barbecued steaks for us last night. That's my favorite food. Filet mignon. Although now, here I go, complicating it. I'm really fond of Mexican food as well. Really, really fond of it. I could probably eat that every day.
We got plenty of both here in Arizona.
Oh golly, I love Arizona.
Trust me,
I love Arizona.
And what do you want for Christmas?
Want for Christmas? Oh golly, that's right. You did ask me that second question. I really don't need much. I think I have most everything that I could ever want, so I really don't need a whole bunch for Christmas. You know what I want for Christmas? I want to have all my kids there with me. I have four kids, two boys and two girls, and three grandsons, and that's what I would want for Christmas, is to get to spend that time with them.
Wow. There have been five responses that over the last 20 years, five of them said, all I want is peace on Earth.
Oh, golly, sure.
Because
yes.
you folks have seen Earth from a vista that we cannot experience. There's no political borders like on a globe or something like that. It's just you look down and think, why can't we all just get along?
Oh, man. You know, I've had that thought sitting up there in orbit. Looking down at the Earth and saying, you know what, okay, we aren't all Americans. We aren't all Russians. So we aren't all Italians. But we are all Earthlings. Why in the world don't we pull together? Maybe what we need is something like the movie Independence Day to happen to us, to where Earth is being attacked by aliens and we all need to pull together as Earthlings. So maybe... Maybe we need something like that.
Captain, thank you so much for your memories from Sound Sounds. Godspeed from the Air Force, aim high. From the Navy, well done.
Well, thank you so much, Rich. It's been a real pleasure visiting with you today and with Arizona, and I can't wait till my next chance to get back to Arizona.
An interview with retired astronaut Robert Hoot Gibson. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
Apollo 8. We close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you. All of you on the good earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.